The Nightingale Conant Corporation presents The Peaceful Warrior's Path to Everyday Enlightenment with Dan Millman. In his words, the path of personal growth leads upward through the gauntlet of human experience to the peaks of our potential. On this journey, we encounter 12 gateways. Their purpose is evolution. Their arena is everyday life. Their secret is action. And their time is now.
Thank you. Before I begin, I want to acknowledge that what I say is less important than how open you are. If you're open enough, you can hear one word and it can change your life. The more open you are, physically, emotionally, mentally, the more comfortable you are, the more you'll get out of this program. We're going to be covering a great deal of material, a journey in a sense, an oft-used metaphor, a journey through 12 gateways of personal growth to human potential, culminating in a practice called everyday enlightenment. We think of enlightenment, most of us, as total peace, total happiness, freedom, love, bliss. In other words, that sound a little like pie in the sky when related to the issues we face in everyday life. So what I intend to do is to bring enlightenment down to earth where we live, where you can really get a handle on it. And I make a promise to you, at the end of this program, I will give you a practice that you can do moment to moment in everyday life, whenever you remember, a practice of enlightenment more meaningful than any I've found. In fact, it is the highest practice ever given to human beings. But before we can reach that practice and prepare ourselves for it, we have to pass through together these 12 gateways that I'll be describing throughout the program. When I was an athlete years ago and a coach, I discovered three things. First thing I discovered was I love teaching more than learning. And I adored learning. But no matter what I learned, only one person benefited. But if I could teach other people, that was exciting to me. I also noticed as a coach that anyone doing any form of skill training needed to build a foundation of fundamentals, of basics, to actually raise their level of talent by working certain basics in the field of athletics. It had to do with strength and flexibility, stamina, rhythm, balance, coordination, timing, reflex speed. If people were willing to work that and develop that foundation, they became more talented in terms of learning the skills easier, faster, and at a higher level. If you're a tennis player, a golfer, or any other person in training, I suggest you go back and look at those basics because your talent goes up. At the same time, I learned a third thing, and that was being able to do handstands and cartwheels and somersaults was not much help to me when I went out on a date. I suppose it depends what kind of date it was, but for the most part, it wasn't much help, nor did it help me when I got married or had children or dealt with financial issues or one of the 101 other things we deal with in everyday life. So I started to look not for the foundation, the basics that develop talent for sport, but I started contemplating what are the basics that develop a talent for living. Few of us have really thought in terms of a talent for living. Often we assume if someone's talented, they're born with it. Well, I don't agree at all. I think our genetic potential maybe is 10 to 20% at most. The rest we develop. It depends on the choices we make and what we do in our daily lives. So I started looking, what are these basics? And it led to what I call the 12 gateways to personal growth or human potential. Now, I'm not suggesting these are 12 gateways. I'm suggesting they are the 12 gateways. And I say this because I've given talks around the world to many, many people. And I've challenged groups, come up with the 13th gateway, come up with the 14th one. No one has. These 12 cover the entire scope. They're a map of the territory of our human potential. I want to make it clear at the outset that these 12 gateways are not 12 burdens I suggest or new practices I suggest you add to an already busy life. Rather, they're meant to lighten you, not burden you, because you're already practicing in all these areas. You've been working on the 12 gateways your entire life, and will continue to do so. What I'm going to do today is present a clear map to bring what is subconscious into full consciousness. So you'll see a map, and you know any map when you're on a journey is a big help. So this is going to be a map to help you get more out of daily life, out of those challenges in the spiritual school we call daily life. Some people refer to daily life as a spiritual boot camp. I prefer to think of it as a school. Many of you may agree. Well, if it is a school, if we're here to learn, again, there are 12 courses we need to pass in order to graduate. Not just one or two. There are specialists in various areas. There are specialists in the arena of a relationship. They say if your relationship and emotions are down, that's the whole ball of wax. Other people will say, no, the key is meditation. If you meditate, you transcend the mind and transcend beliefs and open up to life, and that's the road, the royal road to enlightenment. Other people will say, well, yes, but if your body's in balance, the electrical energies are flowing through your body, it's an enlightened body, and that's the basis for everything else. And they all have good points. But it reminds me of a cartoon I once saw in the New Yorker magazine. It showed a man who was in a hospital bed, wrapped in plaster and tape from his head down to his ankles. His feet were fine, but everything else was wrapped in plaster. And there was a doctor standing near him looking at the man, and the doctor said, you know, as a podiatrist, I'd say you're a lucky man. And isn't that our life? Everyone looks from their own viewpoint. A chain breaks at its weakest link. We need to deal with all 12 areas. The one that interests you the least is probably the one you need to work on the most. It usually works this way. Now, the gateways come at us from all directions in everyday life, sometimes more than one at a time. But in this program, I'll be presenting them in a particular order, each one preparing you for the next. Finally, culminating in the 12th gateway, serve your world, and the practice of everyday enlightenment. We take daily life for granted. One of the higher lessons of the 12 gateways is that daily life is God's classroom. We're often looking for spirituality elsewhere. We look for it only in a church or temple. We look for it only in sitting in a corner doing Eastern internal exercises. Then we say, I'm doing spiritual practices. I've never seen any moment in daily life that isn't a spiritual practice. A man once came up to me and said, Dan, I want to do more spiritual practices. I know there's more to life. But I've got a wife and three kids and a full-time job. And again, he and I laughed about that later. Because his wife and his children and his work were his spiritual practices. And they demand more and develop more than sitting in a cave and meditating. In fact, a man named D'Souza once said, for many years it had seemed to me that my real life was about to begin. But there was always some obstacle in the way. Until it dawned on me that these obstacles were my life. You know the saying, life is what happens while we're making other plans. How many of you knew what you were going to be doing for a living when you were a kid? Very few of us. Adair Lara, the writer, once wrote, and some, like me, are just beginning to guess at the powerful religion of ordinary life, a spirituality of freshly mopped floors and stacked dishes and clothing blowing on the line. In fact, the difficulties of daily life are forms of spiritual weightlifting. They're here to strengthen us. That's how we strengthen our spirit. Daily life will test and teach us. A saint called Ramakrishna once said that if you try to open the shell of a walnut while it's still green, it's almost impossible. But if you wait until that shell is ripe, just a tap and it opens up. This seminar and your daily life are part of your ripening process. Now, I talked about openness and the importance of being open. It's easy to say. But you're going to find what I have to say to you is practical, something you can actually work with. I could stand here and talk to you about the field of infinite possibilities. But what do you do with that? There are many words and abstract philosophies. And as a past athlete and coach, I prefer practical outcomes over abstract philosophy. We already have enough to think about, don't we? Now, I need to cover very briefly, two or three basics before we get into the first gateway. The first is, consider that life is a series of moments. We think of our day being something. You know that saying, carpe diem, seize the day? We can't do that. The best we can do is carpe punctum, seize the moment. Cesar Pavese once said, we do not remember days, we remember moments. Isn't that true? Margaret Bonanno said, you can only live happily ever after on a moment-to-moment basis. I've never met a neurotic in my whole life. Never met one. Not even Woody Allen. I've only met people who have more neurotic moments. But some of those people forget to be neurotic at times, and they function quite well. I've never met an intelligent person, only people who have more intelligent moments. But even some people we call intelligent can have some pretty stupid moments. I'll speak for myself. And I've never met an enlightened being. And I've spent time with some high spiritual masters who have large followings, but I've never met an enlightened being, only people who have more enlightened moments. But I've seen many of these teachers in some distinctly unenlightened moments. That helps resolve the paradox of whether somebody's enlightened or not. It depends what moment you catch them. I think this is a more practical way to look at it than a permanent state. The second major principle we need to understand, I'm only going to touch upon it now, it's going to become very clear as the program continues. Consider what you can and cannot control in life. Know the difference between what you can control and what you can influence. There are many things we can influence in life. For example, you can influence the government by writing to the government, by politicking, by voting, by lobbying. Many ways to influence the government. But can you control the government? Let me define what I mean by control. Control means simply by willing something to happen, by intending it to happen, it happens. That's what direct control is. So you need to be clear, this is going to be a key for the entire program, between the difference of what you can influence and what you can control. We're going to get into some controversial areas, and I'm going to say some things that may be quite different from what you've read or learned. So we'll be exploring what you can and cannot control. We need to come to agreement on one point, though, a very important point. Isn't it true that you're responsible for only that which you can control? If you can't control something, how can you be responsible for it? Does that make sense? Are you responsible for the weather, for example? I don't think so. Unless you can control it. If you can, please get in touch with me later. I'd like to talk to you. Okay, more about that as the program continues. The final point we need to be clear on is that the 12 gateways are not some another achievement program that you bust through the 12 gateways in a weekend on Maui. The 12 gateways, again, are God's classroom, are what we're working on in daily life. The higher purpose of these gateways is to free or liberate your attention. Now, that may seem like an abstract idea. Well, what does that mean, liberate my attention? One of the key principles in all of life. Let me tell a brief story. I was sitting on a curb in Berkeley, California, around 1967. Cars were going by at eye level, exhaust flowing through the streets, litter on the streets. I was eating a pink grapefruit at the time. I just purchased at a health food store. And as I put a piece of grapefruit in my mouth and started chewing it, I looked around, and suddenly, for no reason I can explain, everything was absolutely perfect. I looked at the cars and the exhaust. I don't mean the exhaust was some kind of psychedelic hallucinogenic experience where I was going, whoa, look at that exhaust. Nope. In a sense, it was a normal, ordinary state of consciousness. The exhaust still smelled like car exhaust. The car still was the car. The litter was litter. But the car exhaust was perfect. The cars were perfect. The litter on the street was perfect. I was perfect. The entire world was perfect. In fact, it didn't get any better, and it doesn't get any better than that. Nothing needed to be done. The rest of my life was recess, free play. You might think of that as an enlightenment experience, and it could certainly be described as that. I've had many powerful experiences in my life, but nothing came close to this moment of perfection. And you know what it was? It was simply a few moments of free attention. Most of us don't have free attention. The Rabbi Hillel once said there are three mysteries in this world: air to the birds, water to the fish, and humanity to itself. We're immersed in spirit, in God, in inspiration, in beauty, every moment of our lives. Does the weather person come on the radio or television saying, 30% chance of rain today and 20% spirit out? I don't think so. But we don't notice because our attention is trapped in, how am I going to pay for the car repair? Or my body doesn't feel too good right now. Or what am I going to do about my emotions, my relationships? I have to fix those somehow. So the issues of the 12 gateways hold our attention. But the moment we have just a few moments of free attention, you've had those moments. Think back to your childhood, that garden, that magical garden of childhood. Think back to a week ago or 2 weeks or 5 weeks or a month ago or a year. There were times, ordinary times, yet extraordinary moments when you felt unreasonably happy. I've always suggested to people that there are many reasons to be unhappy in this world. Read the newspapers. And there are not many mental reasons to feel happy. So we have to practice unreasonable happiness. This will become also more clear as we go through the program, how to do that. Exactly how to do that. The point is, we've all had moments of relatively free attention. We could be sitting under a tree, going for a walk, in the shower, and we feel this rising energy. What this program is designed to do is, you address and resolve the issues of the 12 gateways, your attention rises like a bubble up through the ocean, up toward the heart, literally up through your body. And you start to see life through new eyes, through the eyes of the heart. And everything changes, even as life goes on, even as the challenges of daily life go on with children and work and everything else.
The first gateway: discover your worth. No matter how intelligent, attractive, or talented you may be, to the degree you doubt your worthiness, you will tend to sabotage your efforts and undermine your relationships. Life is full of gifts and opportunities. You will open to receive and enjoy them to the degree that you begin to appreciate your innate worth and to offer to yourself the same compassion and respect that you would give to others.
Discover your worth, the first gateway. We need to address the difference between self-worth and self-esteem, because you may be thinking, oh, I already know a lot about self-esteem. We can skip this one. I've read books on self-esteem. Sure, it's valuable, but... Well, self-esteem is quite different from self-worth. First of all, self-esteem is conscious. At any point in the day, I could come up to you and say, what's your level of self-esteem right now on a 1 to 10 scale? And you'd say, well, I feel pretty good about myself right now. I'd say about a 7 or a 4. In other words, you're aware of your level of self-esteem. Self-esteem is about liking yourself, feeling good about yourself, feeling self-confident. No one could deny that's important. It's a nice feeling to have. Self-worth, however, is subconscious. That's why it's so powerful. You're not generally aware of it. Let me define subconscious as that part of our awareness, of our psyche, that is largely unexplored or unexamined. Is that a fair enough definition for now? We can become aware. In fact, what we call consciousness expansion and waking up is making what is subconscious conscious. Many powerful things can happen in our lives. We'll touch upon that in a later gateway. But your sense of self-worth answers the internal question, how good of a person am I? How good of a person am I? Therefore, how much do I deserve of life's gifts and abundance and love and happiness and peace? There's an answer to that question within you, but you may not be fully aware of it. In fact, right now I'm going to ask you to do a little exercise. Think of a scale between 1 and 100. 100 would be if you rated yourself as completely deserving of love, peace, abundance, happiness, a full, rich life. 1, if you rated yourself as a 1, it would be more akin to I deserve the pits of hell. Most of us are somewhere in between. Now let's look at the roots of self-worth. Where does it come from? Why do some people seem to have more self-worth than others? In every culture of the world, when you grew up, you learned the same lesson, no matter what culture you're raised in. You could be raised by a group of wolves. You could be a wild child, but you would still be socialized into that culture by your parents or caregivers. And you would learn very soon that if you are good, you get rewarded, and if you're bad, you get punished. Positive, negative reinforcement. Many forms of reward. Soft voice, touch, holding, gifts, privileges. And the punishments are often the opposite of those things, even physical punishment. We all learned this in growing up. And if your parents were there all the time watching you, noticing your every behavior, they would be very consistent. But most of our parents got tired now and then. And so there were times we behaved badly or imagined we had bad thoughts or feelings. But nobody was there to punish us. Now we learned if you're good, you get rewarded. If you're bad, you get punished. So if nobody else was there to punish us, who did? Someone was watching. And I'm not just talking about God. I'm talking about you. You have kept a subconscious black book, a scorecard of when you've been good and not good. You've thought back on all those times, for example, how kind you were to your parents when you were a teenager. We've been keeping score. The irony is, those of us with the highest vision, the highest ideals and standards, the most sensitive of us, often have the biggest self-worth issues because we never seem to meet our ideals and our standards. Maybe the secret's to have lower standards, I don't know. But somewhere you came up with a number. You don't know what it is consciously, but let me ask you, whenever you want to access the subconscious, ask, what if I knew? If you did an instant scan of your life, all the kind things you've done, the unkind things, come up with a number. Where do you think your level of self-worth might be? On a 1 to 100 scale, what number comes into your mind? Undoubtedly, you're above 50. People below 50 or 40 or 30 or 20 are out there in the streets. They're self-destructing with drugs or negative choices in their lives. The fact that you're listening to this tape program means that you have a pretty good level of self-worth, probably above 50, but where is it? I'm going to ask you to come up with a number and say it aloud in just one moment. Ready? Go ahead, just say your number. How many, let me ask you this. Were you between 50 and 60? Were you between 60 and 70? 70 and 80? 80 to 90? 90 to 95? 95 to 100? Well, I suggest that if you were under 100, you have self-worth issues. Let's take a self-worth assessment. When fortune smiles on you, do you think this can't last? Do you find it easier to give than to receive? Does your life feel like a series of problems? Does money seem hard to come by? Do you find your work or relationships unfulfilling? Do you work long hours? Do you feel driven to work more, do more, be more than other people just to earn your place here on the planet? Do you overeat, smoke, drink alcohol every day, or use other drugs? Do you experience mixed feelings when you receive praise, applause, gifts, or pleasure? Have you turned down or passed up opportunities in education, work, or relationships, and later regretted it? Do you get sick or injured more than many other people? If someone asks the cost of your service, do you price yourself lower than others in your field? If you answered yes to even a couple of those questions, there are some self-worth issues to look at. The reason self-worth is the first gateway is because this will determine all that follows. There are those of us who've taken the seminars, heard the tape programs, read the books. Our life doesn't seem to change much because we don't let it. Ramakrishna once said that an ocean of abundance and bliss can rain down from the heavens, but if we only hold up a thimble, that's all we're going to get. Once in a while, some of us say, no more with this thimble, I'm going to hold up a shot glass. Or a beer mug. Or a sink. But why not a bathtub? Why not a swimming pool? The impact of self-worth on your life happens in a number of different ways. If you have self-worth issues, to the degree you don't appreciate your innate worth, you'll tend to sabotage yourself. Self-sabotage works in our lives in insidious, hidden ways. Again, we don't consciously do it. Self-worth operates on the subconscious level. You don't wake up one morning saying, think I'll sabotage my relationship today. Think I'll sabotage my financial issues. But you've experienced it, haven't you? When things are about to get really intimate and close in a relationship, you find yourself backpedaling. That may be just a little too good for me. When I was the coach of the Stanford University gymnastics team, I walked into the gym one day and Brian, the captain of the team, was lying on the floor stretching one of his legs. Not unusual before workout. But as I walked by him, I heard him go, oh, this hurts so much. I hate this. I looked down. I thought I'd stumble into a Mel Brooks movie. I was going, well, who's doing it to you, Brian? If it hurts that much, why don't you let up a little bit? Many of us could take this guidance in daily life. For 14 years, I taught a martial arts training based on knife fighting. It was a personal growth training, a mystical training, through knife fighting. K-N-I-F-E. And one of the things we did at this training was called the standing ovation. You know, some people at the Academy Awards, the Oscar ceremonies, they get a lifetime achievement award or a great performer, and people give them a standing ovation. But as I look around at people, I see courageous souls who chose to come down to this particular planet to learn. And as I look at you, I see people with innate worth, innate worth. So I think you all deserve a standing ovation. Well, in this training, we had time to do that. People could just stand up and interrupt me at any time and say to the whole group gathered there, excuse me, I'd like a standing ovation. Now, that could be a little scary, especially for those with self-worth issues, those who need it the most. Because their fear, of course, is everyone's going to turn to them and go, oh, you? No. But, of course, we applauded wildly. A lot of love, a lot of energy coming at that person. Hard to absorb. It's quite an experience, I can tell you. And people were dancing around with all this energy. They couldn't even keep grounded. The interesting part was that quite a number of people, after 3 or 5 or 7 or 10 seconds, started waving their hands back and forth in front of them going, that's enough, thank you. I'm getting uncomfortable. Do you see its relationship to self-worth? When do you do that in daily life? How good does it have to get before you start waving your hands saying, I'm getting uncomfortable. I was at the Maui Writers Conference recently, staying at the Grand Wailea Resort, overlooking the ocean. And as they say, it wasn't heaven, but you could see it from there, out in the surf and the sunset. And it put me up against my self-worth issues. Do I deserve this? This is so good. So many of us who say it can't last, you know what? It can get better and better. Your worst moment 10 years from now can be better than any moment you've yet experienced. Life does progress in evolutionary cycles, up and down, but over time, upward. Let's talk a moment more about self-sabotage. Sometimes it's obvious. Sometimes it's big things. We're not paying attention. We get in an auto wreck. We call it an accident. Sometimes our relationship just happens to fall apart, but we don't see our clear role in it. Sometimes we take on a business partner who robs us blind, get them into a messy divorce. These are the choices we make, the choices we make. In another one of my books called The Laws of Spirit, I talk about the law of choices. The choices we made in the past brought us to where we are now. The choices we make today will shape our future. We always have a choice. Some people say, no, this just happened. I didn't have a choice over this. But we always can choose our response to any situation. Life is not always a matter of holding good cards, but sometimes playing a tough hand well. So we always have the power of choice, our response to any moment in time. We need to consider the choices we make in life. It's related to self-worth. Will you take the high road? Will you delay gratification to achieve a greater goal? Are you worth it? In fact, in the Laws of Spirit, the sage, I meet up in the mountains, an ageless woman sage. I'm complaining about something, and she said, oh, by the way, when you go home, I'd like you to ask your wife for a divorce. And I said, what? She said, yes, ask her for a divorce. I said, I couldn't do that. She said, sure you can, just move your mouth and say, I would like a divorce. I said, no, I couldn't do that. And I told her all the reasons. It's bad for the kids, you know, it's hard on the kids, hard on us, it would hurt her, it would hurt me, it's terrible. She said, oh, I understand, you're trapped. I said, no, I didn't say that. She said, it sounds like it. You're giving me all the reasons why you can't get a divorce. The point she was making is that until we reclaim the power to say no, we never truly say yes, do we? We go through life feeling, well, I got to be in my job and I got to be in my relationship. I was married 8 years to a wonderful woman. I was too young. She was too young. We were immature and that marriage didn't last. I brought a certain level of mediocrity to that relationship because I went through the 8 years saying, well, I'm really not happy, but I made a promise. It was on a piece of paper, so I never really took responsibility. Now, when I wake up with joy, I usually wake up before her. I don't usually say this out loud. Sometimes I do, but I look at her and I say to myself, I choose you today to be married to over all women in the world. I get married every morning. In other words, I take full responsibility for my work, what I do, my situations. That's what the law of choices is about. So what choices do we make in response? When life offers us a gift, do we go, oh, that's okay. That's okay. Instead of opening up saying, thank you. Thank you, God. Thank you, Spirit. Thank you, world. Yes. I'd like you to put a sign on your bathroom mirror or your refrigerator. Somewhere you'll see it every morning. When you get up, you read it every morning and it says, how good can I stand it today? Because that's how good you'll get it. Sometimes we have judgments about ourselves that lowers our sense of worth because we felt we really messed up. Of course we all have. We've all said or done things that were unkind. But something we need to consider to really explore this area of worth and what you're worth is that we've done our best every day of our lives. You may not agree with that. You may say, oh, I could have done better. Sure. On some absolute scale of 100%, we could always do better every day. But have you considered your parents did the best they could in raising you? They may have been kind and sophisticated, or they may have been cruel and abusive, but they were doing the best they were capable of at the time, given their wounds, their limitations, their level of awareness. They were doing the best they knew how. In the same way, you've done the best every day of your life, given your present capacity. We need to look at it that way. We are doing our best. And that opens us up to doing even better. Judgments just hold the patterns in place. I'm not talking about developing some artificial self-image and pumping yourself up. I don't want you to pump yourself up just to say, I deserve the best, and then resenting the world or other people for not giving you exactly the service you deserve. Many of us resent when we go into a hotel and they don't have a reservation. Little stuff, you know. What I'm talking about is coming to appreciate your innate, inborn worth that can never be taken away from you as a human being by virtue of being here on the planet. Your human worth. You are worth no more and no less than any human being, any saint, any leader who has ever lived. I don't know if you've considered this before, but I'd like you to. You may not agree, but let me put it another way. Look in the eyes of a young baby sometime. Have you done that recently? Look in the eyes of a baby. When you look at a newborn or a very young child, do you look at that child and go, I'd say that's worth about an 8 on a 10 scale? I don't think so. That child was you. When did you start subtracting? It's not about finding your worth. It's not about raising your worth. You don't need to raise your worth. You're already worth all you can be worth. It's about discovering that. The first step is awareness. Awareness of a problem is the beginning of the solution. Just being aware that you have self-worth issues. Take more and thank more. What if you offered someone a gift and they said, oh, gee, that's really nice, but thanks. No thanks. I really couldn't accept that. How would you feel? Maybe not so great? How do you think God or Spirit feels when gifts are offered to you and you go, oh, that's okay. That's okay. Think about it. If you refuse to accept anything but the best, you very often get it. When you begin to approach life in your relationships, your work, as, you know, maybe I deserve better, you'll get better. That doesn't mean you leave your relationship. It means you start defining your boundaries and saying, this is okay and this isn't. I want to develop a better relationship with the person you're with. People who are abused may need to make some changes. That's a different story. Those cases of low self-worth are apparent, aren't they? When someone is abused by a spouse, a boss, a partner, or by life. They can make some new choices. Marcus Aurelius said, those who live in harmony with themselves live in harmony with the universe. And Annie Truett once wrote, it takes kindness to forgive oneself for one's life. Now the final key. And this is going to become more clear to you as time goes on. You don't have to feel self-worth. It's not about generating a feeling of, oh, now I feel worthy. It's about behaving as if you were the most equally worthy person of anyone who's ever lived. So you may not feel you deserve a suite at the Grand Wailea on Maui. You may not feel you deserve your relationship when it's really good. Or abundance coming in. But you can act as if you do and make different choices. And stop sabotaging your life. In the arena of self-sabotage, look at young celebrities. I know a number of them personally. And some of them are self-destructing. You know the names. You've read about them in the newspaper. With drugs and behaving badly. Suddenly they're adulated by millions of people. Suddenly, they have millions of dollars. Talk about running up against self-worth issues. It's not so easy being rich and famous. Or talented. That's one example of self-sabotage we can relate to. It's right in the newspapers. I read recently that 70% of lottery winners, big winners, are in debt after 1 year. Gee whiz, I wonder what caused that. A sudden influx of money that they didn't actually work hard for? That brings us up against self-worth issues. I would predict those people who gave much of it to charities, did good work with it, continued working, would not be in debt, would make best use of that money. When we turn to the fourth gateway, manage your money, we're going to take another look briefly at self-worth as it relates to money. So ask yourself for a moment, how might I have sabotaged myself in the past or present, in my relationships? Whenever life started getting good, again, awareness is the beginning of healing. The absolute key to discovering your worth and living on that basis, we don't get to until we come full circle to the 12th gateway. When we do, the final page is turned, the final key is opened. When I talk about gateways, by the way, it's simply a metaphor. Could say principles, keys, doorways. The closest synonym is arenas of life that we're dealing with. It's an apt metaphor because it's something we're going through, an entryway. We're passing through these gateways to prepare ourselves, to ripen ourselves for everyday enlightenment. The second gateway, reclaim your will. Inside you is untapped strength of will, of spirit, of heart. The kind of strength that will not flinch in the face of adversity. You have only to remember your purpose, the vision that brought you to earth, and the vision that will take you to the stars, to the depths of the oceans, and up the stairway to the soul. Great strength of will resides within you, waiting only for expression. Now we turn to the second gateway. Reclaim your will. Wouldn't you agree that one of the major challenges in spiritual growth, personal growth, in life is turning what we know into what we actually do? We already have all the information, don't we? There's no lack of information today. We can read about proper diet, exercise, health, and spiritual practices, and we already know what to do, but how do we actually do it? If you have no goals, you don't need any will, do you? You can just wander through life doing whatever is easiest. Normally it's lying horizontally in life. But most of us have goals. Most of us have something we want to achieve, to become, to do, to accomplish. And that takes will. Now, I chose my words very carefully in Everyday Enlightenment. I don't say, strengthen your will. I didn't write, find your will. I said, reclaim your will. We've all made resolutions we haven't stuck with, so we think we lack willpower. But I don't think that's the case at all. I think our problem is we make too many resolutions. Have you ever gone to work or gone to school, or done your homework, or changed somebody's diapers, or done 101 other things when you haven't really felt like doing it? Yes, of course. You see, you already have will. You weren't feeling motivated to do that thing, but you did it anyway. You already have will. In fact, if you could save the life of a child, I think you would astonish yourself with the will you could bring to bear. So let's be clear from the outset that reclaiming your will has nothing to do with, I'm such a weak person, I lack self-discipline, that belief we have about ourselves. You don't lack self-discipline. You just may not have applied it. And that's the key to reclaiming your will. Let's explore an assessment before we go on. How would you compare your level of self-discipline with other people that you know? Do you have a goal, a direction, or a dream in your life? What steps are you taking each day to achieve it? Can you recall a time you demonstrated strong willpower? Can you recall a time when you demonstrated weak willpower? How might you apply your will to influence your diet or exercise habits? How would you assess your will in the area of sexuality? Do your budget and finances reflect self-restraint? Have people ever called you stubborn or willful? And did you thank them? When doing something you enjoy, do you need to apply your will? Why or why not? Have you recently used willpower to act with kindness or courtesy even when you did not feel that way? Would you like a stronger will? And how do you know you don't already have one? These are good questions to contemplate in the arena of will, because unless we start seeing issues that come up for us, it won't seem as relevant to us. But you can see why reclaim your will is the second gateway, because with self-worth issues explored and resolved, and with a strong will, you're ready for the rest of the gateways and for daily life. Let's talk about motivation and will. See, I'm not a motivational speaker. Motivation passes. You may feel motivated after today. In fact, after listening to this program on tape, I expect for about a week or two, you'll have a dispensation of higher energy. Make good use of it. But it won't last indefinitely. Motivation fades like any other feeling. Rather, what I intend to do is to help plant some seeds that will continue to grow that you can apply in everyday life. Sometimes you feel motivated and sometimes you don't. If you wait to feel motivated in your life, then sometimes you do it, but then you don't feel motivated, so you stop, right? And then you feel motivated again, and then you do it for a while, and then you don't feel motivated and you stop. Some of us live between infomercials, waiting for the next hit. Now, there are ways to motivate yourself, and I like motivation. I think it's valuable and useful. When we feel motivated, it doesn't feel like we're working. I trained in gymnastics for many years, and I never felt like, oh, here we go, I've got to do it. Well, actually, I did sometimes. But for the most part, I loved jumping on the trampoline and doing all the things. So I didn't need motivation. I was already pumped up. I enjoyed what I was doing. But there are many things in life we need to do that are difficult. We know that. There are ways to motivate yourself. And again, based on an understanding of how our subconscious works, I want to give you a few keys to motivation. First, our subconscious, as you may know, has the qualities and values of a young child, 4 to 7 years old. There's a certain primitive flavor to the subconscious. It likes new things. Don't we get excited about new things in our lives? New toys. We like to have fun. We like pleasure. Many of us try to motivate ourselves when we get more sophisticated psychologically or spiritually. We motivate ourselves with, this will be good for the upliftment of humanity. This will bring down my higher self. Well, our little basic self, you know, it's kind of going, let's go have a pizza. You need to find ways to motivate yourself that work. When I was a gymnast, I trained for 4 to 4.5 hours every day, 6 days a week. I knew exactly where I was going to be, 3 p.m. every day. Sometimes I was so tired when I left the gym, I could barely walk up the stairs. Do you think I worked that hard because I knew someday it would help prepare me for the teaching work I was to do intuitively? I don't think so. You think maybe I did it because I knew it was constructive, good activity to do, to balance my life, that it was a form of spiritual practice? Nope. I could go on. I think you get the point. The reason I worked so hard was to try to develop this short body so I could attract girls. Now, I admit it wasn't the highest motive, and it wasn't altogether successful either. But that's what got me going every day. My coach understood this. When I was a freshman at Berkeley, our coach knocked out one of the walls to the gym and put a window there, a large window, so co-eds walking to their classes would glance at us working out. And when they did that, we were always aware out of the corner of our eye who was looking in that window. And we lost all fear of death. It's amazing what a little motivation will do. So if you want to motivate yourself, don't just look for the higher motives, because that's lovely, but it doesn't grab the basic self. That's in the subconscious. That's what gives you your vital energy for life. You know how some of us are not night people and we just get sleepy early in the evening, but if a friend we haven't seen for 10 years comes by the house, we can be up late half the night talking with them, because our basic self, our subconscious, is giving us the energy to do that. Let's say you're going through law school or medical school or some other schooling. I mean, how many doctors, for example, in medical school or pre-doctors got up every morning and went, "Oh boy, I get to go to medical school today." Not too many. Same for any professional school. But if they can picture themselves a doctor, a physician, out there on the golf course. I meant in the hospital, saving someone's life, doing surgery, serving people, of course, that can pull them like a beacon, like a magnet. You see, between us and our goals is not usually a red carpet. Have you noticed? More often, it's a swamp. My oldest daughter, Holly, is going back to college. She's in college now. She has 2 sons. She's decided she really wants to better herself. I'm thrilled for her. But it's tough. You can imagine. Yet if there's something shining for you at the end on the other side of the swamp, it will pull you through that. You'll hardly notice it. There's a saying, problems are what happens when we take our eyes off the goal. When our eyes are on that goal, we're just going toward it. And there's just obstacles to step over on the way. So that's the key to motivation. Think about what's going to excite you, what is fun. Down the line, even if it's a vacation you're looking forward to. Vacations, by the way, are not luxuries. They are worth their weight in gold. You'll get more done at the end of the year if you take more vacations than if you didn't. Because your subconscious will open up and deliver creativity and energy. You know how it is before you go on vacation, all the things you get done, tied up. So sure, motivation is useful. Motivation is like an umbrella if you're going out in the rain. If you're going to go out in the rain and you have an umbrella, might as well use it. But motivation is fickle. You can't always, and you're not going to always, feel motivated. How many of us want to affirm our worth and our power so we can develop the courage to generate the motivation, to find the inspiration, to create the persistence, to develop the commitment, to finally do whatever it is we need to do? Many of us, that's our method. And it's thankless and it's fruitless. That's why we don't get too many places sometimes. There's another way. There's a second way to reach your goals. And I like to quote them. Three words I first heard from Saint Nike. Just do it. It comes down to that. It always comes down to that, no matter what in daily life. One reviewer of Everyday Enlightenment said, Milman is too simplex in his approach. He's saying, just do it. And people who have addictions to drugs, he's saying, just stop. Without suggesting people go into a treatment program. Well, actually, I think that reviewer misunderstood what I was getting at. Because sometimes things are easy to do. You know, taking the kids to school. Not too tough. We may not feel like it, but we can do it. Sometimes what we need to do is very difficult. Stopping smoking. You know, tobacco is 4.5 times as addictive as heroin. Real challenge. Stopping alcohol abuse or drug abuse. Very difficult. I want to acknowledge that. But you know what? Difficult is not the same as impossible. Life is difficult. That's why we're here. It's like a climb up a mountain path. It is uphill. We overcome obstacles on the way. They fall in our path. Sometimes it's very difficult. We're climbing and clawing our way up. But you know what? The higher you climb, the better the view, because you see the bigger picture. More rewards. Yes, sometimes it's very difficult. Someone on substance abuse or dealing with that issue, whether they go to a treatment program, do 12-step programs, AA, NA, whether they have intervention of loving friends and families, whether they hit bottom, whether they get afraid enough or inspired enough to stop, they all stop exactly by the same method. What is it? They just stop. They don't just stop once, they stop 1,000 times. Every time they feel compelled that their thoughts or feelings are saying, you need to do this, take it again, have another drink, whatever it is. No matter what process they go through to get to that point, it always ends up the same place. Just stop. Don't do it. 12-step programs for many, a substance abuse, other difficulties in life are often our entryway into spiritual life, into finally confronting what we need to do. So the School of Life has many different classrooms. There are people in prison who have stopped and dropped all the facade, all the pretense. They get pretty honest because there's nothing else left to do. They become like warrior monks. Everything can be used to lift and to serve. A chance to apply and reclaim our will. I'm going to ask you, and if you're listening to this tape in your car, I wouldn't recommend doing this now, but when you have a chance, I'd like you to do the following exercise. I'd like to give you the opportunity to experience what it's like to reclaim your will. What I'm going to describe to you as clearly as I can is, you're going to take a particular stance, which is called by a Tai Chi master, a master of Tai Chi Chuan, a Chinese martial art. It's also a Qigong exercise, again, a Chinese healing art. He calls it the cosmic stance. He said once, if you love your parents, teach them the cosmic stance. If you want to give a gift to a friend, teach them the cosmic stance. If there's only one exercise you ever did, practice the cosmic stance. I want to teach it to you now. Would you stand on one leg, almost entirely on one leg? Now you're going to turn that leg. Your foot will be not directly forward. It will be 45 degrees to the side. So turn your foot slightly out. And put all your weight on that leg. Let your knee bend just slightly. Tuck your hips under. Imagine a string is pulling the back of your head up toward the ceiling. So your posture is going to be very straight, good posture. Hips tucked under, knee relaxed, not stiff. Your front leg will be there just for balance. The ball of your foot is barely touching the floor so that you could lift the front leg up or put it down without shifting your weight. Okay, it's just there for balance. The front foot is directly in front of your back heel. If there's a line from your back heel going directly forward, your front foot is on that line. So your feet make a kind of triangle from your heels out to your toes. Now, facing forward, I'm going to ask you to let your arms float up in front of your body and round the elbows out, fingers and thumbs pointing directly toward one another, about 4 inches between your fingertips. As if you're holding a big beach ball in front of your chest, not as high as your shoulders, but as high as your chest. Elbows out, big beach ball you're hugging. Now I'm going to ask you to hold that position. Breathing is very specific during this cosmic stance. Inhaling through the nose, exhaling any way you wish. Breathe slowly and deeply, more deeply than you normally breathe, but without any sense of strain. Breathe as deeply as you can. Now, some of you will already be feeling some discomfort in your shoulders or arms. If you are, you're not alone. Know this. The object, the goal, the challenge I'm putting to you is to hold your arms up as long as you possibly can during this exercise. Your mind will say, this hurts too much. Your body will say, this hurts. But let me assure you, this is a benign exercise. It's not related to your physical strength. It's related to the amount of tension you carry in your shoulders and back and arms. The more tension you chronically carry, the more discomfort you feel. I've seen football players try to do this, and the first time they try to do the cosmic stance, they're like in agony, and their arms drop back down after just, 30 seconds. And I've seen a young woman, tragically anorexic, just skin and bone, no muscle at all, hold this for half an hour because she didn't have much tension. This exercise is a healing exercise because it actually will burn through the tension you've carried sometimes for years and begin to release that tension stored underneath the shoulder blades, in the shoulders, and the arms. Even doing this once has a beneficial effect. So I'm sure right now as you breathe slowly and deeply into your lower belly, feel your belly expand as you inhale. Feel your belly relax back in as you exhale. Breathing in slowly, deeply, breathing out slowly and deeply. Imagine there's energy flowing out of your right arm and into your left in a circuit going round and round through your arms and up and down your back, up through the top of the head and back down. Imagine or become aware of that energy. Right now, you may be more aware of that feeling in your leg or your shoulders. Sink into the leg. If it's uncomfortable, just sink down into it. And again, make this a challenge for yourself. See if you can keep the arms up despite the discomfort. It will not hurt you. On the contrary, it helps. You're burning through that discomfort. Is burning through the tension in your body. And you'll notice this. It's measurable. What I'm going to ask you to do now, very slowly, is to shift your weight, without moving your arms, shift your weight to your opposite leg, foot turn 45 degrees out, the back foot, sink down into that leg, your entire weight is on your back leg again, the opposite one now, the ball of the foot on the front foot is barely touching the ground for balance, the back of your head is being pulled up, tall, good posture, holding that beach ball. After practicing this exercise, it hurt me a lot the first time I did it. Quite uncomfortable. I carried a lot of tension. And the second day was easier, and the third day, I started with 4 minutes each side, then I worked up to 5, 7, 9, until I could do about 15 minutes each side. Most of us don't have time to do this. But hey, you can watch television doing the cosmic stance. I only did it for about 3 weeks or a month with enough time. I had significantly less tension in my back and shoulder area. If you're there all by yourself doing this still, you're learning about reclaiming your will. It's uncomfortable, but you formed a goal. Consider this. That's what reclaiming our will is. So many of us are waiting to find this amorphous thing called willpower before we'll do whatever it is we want or need to do. That's not how it works. We wait to overcome self-doubt, to overcome fear, to overcome insecurity, whatever. The way you reclaim your will is to just do it, whether you feel like it or not. What a radical approach to life. And that's how you reclaim your will. Life is about transcending tendencies. I was once involved with a spiritual community in which the leader of that community, when people came into the community who were profligates, libertines, hedonists, you know, omnivores, he would say, from now on, you're working 8 hours a day at a regular job, keep a stable relationship, and I want you to eat an organic, vegetarian diet, here on out. Those people who came into the community already doing that, who were really righteous, you know, vegetarians, purists in their diet, and many of them were attracted to the community who were already doing that, he'd say, come on, he'd take them fishing, and they'd eat the catch. And he'd say, I want you to just party a while. And he'd declare these wild parties where people were just no rules. The point was not that one is better than the other, but it was about transcending tendencies, loosening up a little bit, playing different roles in life for a period of time. We tend to be lazy, or we tend to overwork and be compulsive. We tend to be passive, or we tend to be aggressive. We tend to let our emotions run our lives. We tend to do many things, and life is about transcending those tendencies. You know, I went through a weird stage in my life when I would be reading a book, like a suspense novel. Many of you, you know, you've probably done that. And I was, just before I got to the end, just before I found out what happened, I closed the book and never looked at it again. I'd be watching a television program, and just before the end, when you find out who did it, whatever, I would just turn off the set. Sometimes it was very difficult, but I just click it off and I felt free right then and there. It was like letting go, which is what meditation is all about. More on that later. But that's also about transcending tendencies and gaining self-mastery. That's what reclaiming our will is about. The Japanese have a saying, fall down 8 times, get up 9 times. That's the difference. It's not people who don't fall down, it's those who get up one more time. In fact, Ella Wheeler Wilcox, the poet, once said, like the winds of the sea are the ways of fate as you voyage along through life. 'Tis the will of the soul that decides the goal and not the calm or the strife. George Bernard Shaw once wrote, never mind likes and dislikes, they are of no consequence. Just do what must be done. This may not always be happiness, but it is greatness. Shoma Marita, a name you've heard before, said these are 3 basic guidelines for living. Accept your feelings, know your purpose, and do what needs to be done. Muhammad Ali once said, champions need skill and will, but the will must be stronger than the skill. Rabindranath Tagore said, you can't cross the sea merely by staring at the water. You know how to access your higher will. The higher will goes beyond yourself. I know many 12-step programs live by, not my will, but thy will be done. When we call upon a higher will to assist us in life through prayer, through contemplation, through reflection, that there is a great will operating in the world, and when we channel that, nothing can stop us. That sense of inspiration, because we're working for a higher cause. We step into that stream of spirituality, which is far beyond the separate self trying to succeed in life. So one way to access that is to say, not my will, but thy will be done, and ask, what might that be? You ask yourself, if I were my higher self, what would I do right now? What would my higher self suggest to me right now? Or use a model, somebody that you admire, a great figure, spiritual leader or other leader in history. Draw upon that as a model and become that. We're all shamans. We're all shapeshifters. We can take on the energy of animals, of people, to accomplish goals at hand. It doesn't just happen in the martial arts. It can happen in daily life. And you can amaze yourself at the will you can bring to bear. When you know it's not just about you and that cookie, or piece of cake, or exercise, when you don't feel like it? It's not just about that. This is about reclaiming your will and growing into your full humanity. That's just a little test. Does it mean you have to be perfect from now on and never succumb into a little treat? No. You know, there are some foods that may not be that good for the body, but they're good for the soul in that moment. So it's not about being compulsively, you know, make it a religion of will. But in general, when you need it, it's there for you. And you can call upon the higher will whenever you need it. You're going to find that as we go through each progressive gateway, the ones that preceded will become more clear. But with that, I close the second gateway with a whole greater clarity on will, how we bring it to bear in life. I don't just wish you well, I wish you will.